Welcome to the Experts in Sport podcast, brought to you by Loughborough University. This podcast seeks to bring together the worlds of academia and professional practice. If you're interested in the latest research and trends in sport, then this is the podcast for you. So today we're with Steve Johnson, and we're going to be talking about the Wellbeing Science Institute. We'll discuss Steve's background in sports psychology, the development of the Wellbeing Science Institute, and the partnership that's been developed with Loughborough University. So, hi Steve, thanks for joining us on the Experts in Sport podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me today.
No worries. Our listeners will know this, but we often start with our guests providing us with a brief background of their career. So can you provide us with a background on your career and the developments of the Wellbeing Science Institute?
Well, if I go way back, I actually started as a personal trainer. And while I was going to university, I paid my way through university by being a personal trainer. And that taught me a lot about people. It taught me a lot about psychology and taught me a lot about well-being, obviously. And I managed to not only have a pretty successful personal training business, but also started the Australian Personal Trainers Association. Then after graduating sports psych, I managed to get a role on the ATP tennis tour and spent 2 years traveling with a couple of Australian players. And that was a real learning experience around some of the challenges of professional sport. And then went and taught at university. So I initially started out as a tutor and then became a lecturer and actually wrote the first undergrad sports psych degree in the Southern Hemisphere. And it was the first time an undergrad course had offered sports psychology. In Australia, typically you had to wait until a master's degree before you could actually get into, you know, your top of your choice. So that was an exciting time. But then the job came up for tenure, and I was an early academic, and someone from the US had applied for the job, and of course with a fairly extensive research background, so they got the job, and I was disappointed. So I thought I'll do something else, and so I went into organizational psychology and started working in organizations. And that was a great learning curve, because what that led to was learning about how organizations work and how they specifically work from a change perspective. And then after a reasonable hiatus, I got sucked into the world of executive land, ended up working in financial services, ended up working at C-suite, an investment firm. Then in 2012, I went and worked for a Boston-based consulting firm, which was called the Levinson Institute, which was started by the legendary psychologist Harry Levinson. And there I learned a lot about how globally psychology has influenced business and some of the tools and processes. And after the Levinson Institute, I decided I wanted to go back and do what I really love, which was sport. And at that point, I decided to deliberately work with sporting organizations, and I approached a number of sporting organizations around the topic of leadership and well-being. And I think in sport generally there's this intersection of leadership, culture and well-being, and one organization, one of the largest sports in Australia, was going through a particularly difficult time due to a doping scandal. So they asked me to help them with that, and I developed some programs which I think had a reasonable impact. And certainly there were a couple of scandals going on in Australian sport at the same time, and I think this organization handled it pretty well compared to some others. And at that point, the opportunity to design a wellbeing program came up for the sporting organization, which was the National Rugby League, one of the biggest sports in Australian sport. So I designed a program for their staff, and that was the beginning of developing a whole wellbeing strategy for them. And out of that was born the Wellbeing Science Institute, because the person who I was working with, the head of wellbeing, a guy named Paul Heptonstall at the NRL, asked me if we could convert this program into a qualification. And I foolishly said yes, mainly because getting a qualification up in Australia is quite a challenging experience. And having written a university degree, I thought, well, this will be a doddle. But actually proved to be more challenging than I anticipated. And so for the last 6 years, the Wellbeing Science Institute has been delivering the world's first qualification in elite athlete wellbeing management. And for the last 2 years, we've had a partnership with Loughborough University. That started back in 2019. We ran the first program at Loughborough. Then, of course, COVID hit. We were stuck in Australia and couldn't come to Loughborough. So we ran our second program completely online. And then this year we just completed our third face-to-face program, and the next one comes up in September. So that's a quick overview. It's been interesting. I've lived in many countries, lived in the US, lived in Europe, plan to live back in Europe, even lived and worked in Abu Dhabi. So it's been quite an experience. Many challenges along the way, learn a lot about people, learn a lot about change. And we've put, you know, a lot of that knowledge into our wellbeing programs.
That's an amazing introduction. I could dig into that all day. I'm sure there's some psychology around that, of the whole where you started out, where you went to, what you came back to, your love. There's some great kind of depth we could dig into with that. Obviously, we've already had conversations prior to us recording this, but obviously there's some synergy between you and I. The personal training piece, so some of our listeners will already know, personal training really is where I started, and it was in Australia. So I worked in Randwick for a company called Vision Personal Training. At the time, they were a very fast growing franchise. Absolutely loved being out in Australia. So really interested to know, you know, about your development of personal training, but we're not here to talk about that. I could talk about that forever. The other bit that I was really interested in is obviously you worked in consulting and you talked about leadership and culture and well-being. I've got real interest in more leadership and culture side of things, but I find it interesting that within sports organisations, much of the research in leadership and culture has been done at a manager type coach level. And I'm really more interested in the owner, organisational kind of chairman level. That's something I, in the future, want to kind of dig into, some of that leadership side of things. So I was just listening to your career and just thinking, wow, you've been all over. You've dipped in and out and grown knowledge into so many different spaces. And then that's brought you to create the Wellbeing Science Institute. So just digging deeper into that, why did you feel there was a need to develop the Wellbeing Science Institute?
I think I've always believed that it's possible in organizations, and I view sporting organizations simply as organizations. There's a different context to them. But if you don't have effective leadership, you don't have effective strategy. And if you don't have effective strategy, the business will decline. So I think it's imperative to have, you know, strong leadership and governance. But it's also important to actually be thinking what makes success in businesses is people. And I'm not sure the majority of leaders really understand the way to manage the bottom line isn't by managing the bottom line. I don't think leaders understand that generally. The way to manage the bottom line is through effectively managing your people. And I've always believed that. So when I held, you know, roles at C-suite or as head of global leadership in 120,000 organizational person role, I was always trying to think about win-win. How do you make a win for the organization and the shareholders, but how do you make a win for the people who actually create that value? That was always central to my thinking. One of the things that is often lacking is that in leadership is that people in leadership roles don't understand what the levers are for effective people leadership. And it's because that people who generally get to the top in organizations have never held that role. They'll have held finance roles or marketing roles or sales roles, but they've rarely have held the people leadership role. And yet it's one of the key drivers to success. And that always seemed like a no-brainer for me, that leaders need to have that. And I think what I'm observing is I think women more naturally have that than men. So I think we're seeing, just because they pay more attention to it. And men, again, massive generalization, but I think men typically focused on the task, and women can focus both on the task and on people.
That's a very interesting perspective on leadership. I actually have done a podcast. I think the last podcast we released was with John Steele, who you all know, and that was on leadership. And I found John to be an outstanding leader. And we discussed servant leadership a lot and where that came from his military background. So listeners, if you want to listen to that, go and listen to that about John Steele. But interesting points that you made there around females and whether I'm using the right terminology, but the traits potentially that females might have, and you'll know around transformational and transactional leadership. I think that a lot of the research would suggest that females have more of the behaviours associated with transformational leadership, and that's probably a better way of leading people. Would that be a right assumption?
Well, I probably wouldn't necessarily describe it as traits, because traits imply it's within. I think it's about learning, and it's about roles and stereotypes and language. And I think I'm not a big fan, to be honest, of the whole notion of personality or traits, but I am a big fan of learning and observation of behavior and education, because I think those personality style, trait-based methods create shortcuts for people which aren't necessarily accurate.
Yeah, I did mention traits, and then I did say behaviors afterwards. I knew that was coming. So the other interesting thing with the transformational leadership type stuff would be that a lot of things from what I've read would imply that transformational type leadership is good for change and performance in a lot of situations, and that females might have more of those behaviors. Yet there's not that many female leaders comparatively in sport.
Yeah, well, again, I think if you look at the opportunities, who has dominated sport forever? It's been men. Where have been the role models? I mean, you would have seen the incredible reaction around the country with the Lionesses last week. And, you know, when did women get to see women in that situation before? But what it clearly showed me was that if you invest in it, and I think Baroness Campbell has done an incredible job in getting football to where it is. If you invest in it, you get the right leadership in charge, then amazing things can happen. And I think we all need to accept that sport has been very patriarchal. That can no longer be the case. And women is equally capable and willing and able to make a huge difference in elite sport. But it's important that men understand that this is not a threat. This is actually good for sport. And the more we can support, invest, assist, challenge, mentor, the more sport benefits. You know, you have diversity, you get better results, full stop. Now people need to accept that.
I mean, there's so much evidence around diversity and how that improves performance. And I love your point that men should embrace it. And I genuinely think there's been a step change very recently in male acceptance of football, of female football. Certainly, I think the Euros has had a big impact. You know, more and more of my friends who may traditionally have not watched it have watched it. And, you know, comments like, oh, they're actually quite good. And some of the comments of it's not the same as male football, and families can be there and watch it and actually everybody be involved. There's so many positives coming out of it. I hope it's going to happen. I think it's going to happen. But as they've really been starting to push at the end now for people to attend Women's Super League fixtures, you know, let's hope that occurs. And it isn't just football. And I think this is a really pressing point that some people have made. You know, it's female sport. It's not just football.
Yeah.
And I saw many comments from people around this, and that, you know, just like males, some girls hate football, but they need opportunities in loads of other sports. So I know that in Australia, netball is outstanding in Australia. And we've got really high level netball at Loughborough with Loughborough Lightning. And that's an amazing family kind of atmosphere to go to. And so hopefully that culture that seems apparent within female sport actually influences male sport. That would be unbelievable. And yeah. I hope it happens.
Yeah, I think it can, but what it's going to require is investment and patience. And we all need to accept that the primary beneficiaries of the investment in male sport have been males. And so now there needs to be an equal investment and equal patience into the infrastructure, the systems, the processes into female sport. And if that happens, we could expect female sport to continue to grow and develop and participation numbers continue to explode. And I think, again, that's good for sport. But it's great to see that administrators are waking up to this opportunity. But it's taken a long time.
Well, I think as well, from a cynic's perspective, I think some of the professional game have woken up to the financial opportunities as well. And whether they label it as that or other, I think that's part of it.
I think it's part of it.
No, definitely. As we know, and as we spoke about before, we can go off in all directions with this conversation. So I'm going to bring it back to what we're really here to talk about, which is more about your development and the Science Wellbeing Institute. So as you develop this, what's your underlying beliefs in psychology and wellbeing, and how have they kind of, you know, manifested themselves in the development of the business?
I guess what we mean by wellbeing probably sums up what we're about. So the Wellbeing Science Institute of Wellbeing is to move toward your whole person potential and live your life in a valued way. And a valued way simply means in alignment with your values. So what we're about is we're an organization helping people move toward their potential. But helping people also recognize that living their life in alignment with their values is an important part of not only life satisfaction, but quality of life and ultimately longevity. So that's what we're really trying to do, but we're trying to scale that idea, scale it in terms of organizations and communities as well. And that was really what we set out to do from day one, to help people understand what well-being was, help people acquire the skills so that they could take care of their own well-being in a self-determined way, and so they could actually make a difference locally to their families, more broadly to their communities, and hopefully to the planet as well.
I like how you explained and described that. Obviously, that real holistic approach of them influencing others as well. When we've discussed things before, you've obviously spoken about an evidence-based approach.
Yep.
So can you talk us through how you use an evidence-based approach within your system?
Yes. So for us, an evidence-based approach means three things. It means a minimum, as a level of standard, a minimum standard of all the research and the tools and systems that we would advocate, we believe have to be demonstrated in a randomized controlled trial at a minimum. So strong evidence base in terms of the research that we advocate, that we follow, that we would support in our programs. The second piece is we believe that people who work in wellbeing should be qualified in elite athlete wellbeing. Now, at the moment, there are very few courses which actually focus on elite athlete wellbeing around the world. In fact, as far as we know, we are the only organization who actually has a qualification in elite athlete wellbeing management. The other courses that may be out there claiming to be elite athlete wellbeing are actually a merger between athlete performance and wellbeing. And we think there's an important distinction to be made, but we can come back and talk about that. And then the third pillar is that we believe that an evidence-based model is focused on the needs of the particular population, whether it be athletes, coaches, or officials. So that's the crux of what we mean by evidence-based. And then we believe that the starting point is having a clear strategy, which is based on evidence-based principles. And some of the evidence-based principles that we founded our program on are the principles of positive psychology, the principle of self-determination theory, the principle of solution-focused coaching, and the evidence-based principle of personal growth initiatives. So that those kind of frameworks and principles underpin pretty much everything in our program.
Brilliant. And obviously people can go away, Google those things. We could put some links into some of these research pieces that I know you've sent through to me for them to dig into a bit deeper if they have an interest in this subject. So you've got your evidence-based approach, you've got your kind of system of doing things. They've then manifested that into a model. Can you talk us through the model that you use with athletes to ensure that there is this whole person approach?
Yes, and I guess one of the things we've learned is that if you're going to do wellbeing in an organization, you've got to start at the beginning. And for us, we think it's really important. You actually define what you mean by wellbeing, and you've got to be able to define it in a way which actually connects with your audience. And so that's the first step. And then the next step is you need a way of representing how well-being practically gets lived in people's lives. So we have a nine-dimension well-being model, which includes physical well-being, psychological well-being, relationships, because they're fundamental to our well-being. We have culture, spirituality, community, financial, environment, all sitting in this well-being model, but in the center, a person's values and character strengths. And we believe that that model gives the opportunity to communicate the potential options for people to consider their well-being. So we don't say this model applies to everybody, but we're pretty sure that aspects of that model will appeal to everybody. And that's where the self-determination piece kicks in. We actually ask people, what here resonates with you? And what are the areas of well-being that you are going well? What are the areas that potentially you could invest some more time and effort in? And then we work with people to co-create wellbeing plans. Now, having said that, our goal is not necessarily to work with wellbeing one-on-one individuals. our role is to enable, to build capacity for people who work with athletes, coaches and officials, so that they can take an evidence-based approach, they can design wellbeing systems and processes so that they can do wellbeing work in their sporting organization. So we see ourselves as the enabler for the organization in capacity building. And that capacity building takes place in three levels: the organizational level, at the system level and the process level, and then, of course, also for the person who we work with to enable, because they learn more wellbeing skills they can apply in their lives for the people that really matter to them as well.
I really like both. I like the merger of your framework, your wellbeing wheel, and the capacity building at three levels that you talk about. So can we just dig a little bit deeper into how that works? Because, you know, on paper, you've got all these nine areas, you've got all these areas that you can work with, you've got organizational, professional, personal level. And, you know, that is brilliant. It's hitting everything we need. But we know the practicalities can sometimes kind of cause issues. So how do you get an organization to embed this systematically at an organizational level? So let me just give you some context on that. You might be trying to build a culture of well-being, but you're in a performance environment. So what comes first when there is that situation where, you know, let's say there's potential injury? This is one of the common ones. There's a physio saying, maybe you shouldn't play. There's a manager wanting somebody to play, and there's a player who wants to play and says they're fit. Where does that sit in that well-being piece?
I think the most important word to include here is the word "and." So it's not an either or choice, it's an and. And performance and well-being go together. And well-being is a performance enabler. When organizations understand that, it's a logical investment for them, but it's also a competitive advantage. I was had a meeting a couple of weeks ago with one of the largest sporting codes in England. And in fact, one of the largest sporting codes in the world. And they said, well, What's the argument? And I said, well, the argument is that well-being is a competitive advantage, full stop. Now, if CEOs don't understand that, coaches don't understand that, well, they're probably not going to be a sustainable CEO or coach. But if you look at who does get it, the people who do understand people and they invest in well-being, then it's a no-brainer for them. And they actively, you know, understand it's the integration of the two that engages people, that builds capacity, that acts as a retention tool for the organization. It's an attractor for people to come and work in the organization. And it's also a tool for discretionary effort, because people will put in more because they know they're valued and they feel like they belong. Now, when people get that, that's a great organization. But if they don't, then you see all sorts of crazy and poor behavior.
So how have you challenged and brought about change from traditional type values that may have existed within sporting organisations relevant to kind of what I just said? Because there's a lot of short-termism with particularly around managers and short-term results. And therefore, and again, traditionally, it's about short-term results a lot of the time, or it has been. And therefore, that long-term well-being might have been something that wasn't accepted as deeply as it possibly should have been. So have you seen changes, and what changes have you seen? And I know I shouldn't really ask two questions in one, but I'm going to. And how have you helped influence that change by implementing your programs?
Well, I think the first point I'd like to make is that we're early in the journey. We're not there yet. So people's eyes are being open to the value of wellbeing, the importance of wellbeing. I think actually COVID fast-tracked that in many ways. But I think there are three types of organizations: those who are serious, who are considered, develop a clear strategy, realize that you're on a 3 to 5 year journey, and the journey never ends. So in other words, 3 to 5 years to get the infrastructure, the systems, the processes, the people, and the engagement up and running. Just that exercise alone is a 3 to 5 year journey. And then to keep it going and keep it real and to keep it appealing to people, because people come and go and generations, you know, change their views on what really matters. So you've got to be on that journey. So that's the first type of organization. Second type of organization sees its value, but they're really only, it's only window dressing. They're not really serious. They don't make the investment. It's a bolt on. It's not core to who they are. And there's a third, and I call them unconscious organizations, where they don't actually understand what's going on and why it's going on. And they're trying to deal with the symptoms of the problem, not the underlying cause, which, you know, is that win-win idea I was talking about earlier.
So of all the organizations in sport, and this is a crazy question that you can't really get the answer right to, but of all the organizations in sport that you've worked with or that you're aware of, where would you say that sits in terms of, there's three types of organization. How many are in that top bracket? How many are in the middle and how many at the bottom? Because you say we're early in that journey.
Yeah, I would say if we're talking about doing holistic well-being at a systematic level with a clear well-being strategy with capable and qualified people in the roles, we're talking less than three organizations. Three globally.
Wow. You know,
There's the size of the opportunity. Now, just as an example, in the last couple of days, the ATP has just advertised for the first time head of well-being and player care. So for the first time. Now, I used to work on the tennis tour, so I'm applauding them. However, back then when I was working on the tennis tour, I was working in a holistic way with players. Their rankings went from outside 200 inside the top 30. So that it said to me that there's a performance enabling piece to it. But having said that, look, there's only three organizations around the world. I know one of them. I'm probably not going to name the other two. I do think that organizations are on the journey. They're starting to understand that this is huge for sport, huge for their athletes, coaches and officials. And, you know, I would argue that coaches and officials are the most neglected part of the sporting world, and they equally need, if not more, the well-being support the organizations could offer. But I would also say that organizations are waking up, but it's like with strategy, you know, well-being is going to be one of the most overused words in sport. Now, the question is, what happens when you lift up the bonnet and look underneath and say, apart from the smoke and mirrors, what have you really got here? And that's when it's going to get interesting.
No, definitely. I like the point you talked about coaches, and I presume you also are including support staff within that coaches kind of piece, because it's an interesting one with well-being, because people will talk about athlete well-being a lot. But, you know, we know what a high-performance cultural environment might traditionally have looked like. And it's working hard. It's working long hours. It's working antisocial hours.
Yes.
It's answering questions at all hours of the day. It's often, you know, when
it's a very, you know,
it is when, you know, when players are on holiday, often the staff actually aren't, or it's a very short window of holiday. So I think that's a really interesting point, because you're not going to change anything culturally unless you hit every part of the organization, as your framework suggests. So I really do like that. I've got a couple of other questions just linked to your capacity at three levels. So that distinction between personal and professional, and particularly in young athletes. So you spoke about tennis. You know, my daughter plays tennis. She's quite good. She's got a number of coaches asking her to do more and more and more. And, you know, she's young. But in many sports like tennis, like gymnastics, like swimming, young athletes have been traditionally asked to do a lot of training at a young age. And I was the head of education at a professional football club. And there's this, you know, and it's probably parents' perception as well, that there's only one chance and one opportunity, and they need to put everything in to this to make it as a professional, and they can worry about their education later. That has started to change, but there's still an element of that around. So how do you bridge that gap between professional and personal with individual athletes and coaches?
Well, I think the evidence has been there for some time, and some of my own personal research, which was done, you know, many years ago now at the Australian Institute of Sport, around identity and the risks associated with unidimensional focus on identity. I think that's been well documented, well understood for some time, despite the fact that that's been well understood in academic circles. It's not necessarily well understood in sporting circles. And the problem in sport is we usually have singular measures of success, and we need to change that. Singular measures of success usually mean championships, medals, podiums, and that's the only thing that counts, and that's the only way coaches get rewarded. Now, you see the consequence of that all around the world. I was just recently at the TAS conference, and there was four speakers from four different countries talking about their approach to well-being in elite sport. Now, every single one of them have had major reports written about the failings in elite sport, whether you're talking gymnastics, whether you're talking hockey, whether you're talking cycling or swimming. The problem is when it's only focused on performance. That's problematic for the athletes. It's problematic for their time as an athlete, and obviously as transitions take place in sport, as they invariably do, through to injury, motivation, retirement, or just simply moving locations. All these transitions, if it's only a single focus on performance, is detrimental. There needs to be other things there that are engaging, that are protective, that are buffering to the demands of elite sport. Now, you can argue that the case, as I've heard, people do, look, if you want to be elite, you need to be singly focused, you need to be different. In fact, you'll have many different psychological traits. Yes, that may be true for the elite of elite, but that's not the majority of people who are elite athletes. They are the exceptions, the continuous world championship winners, the continuous Olympic medal winners. They're a minority. So we shouldn't be taking that model and applying to the majority of elite sport people. So if we're serious about actually wanting to invest in well-being and serious about helping the whole person, not just the athlete, then we need greater education of coaches. We need to make sure that accreditation of coaches doesn't just include skills and drills and badges. We need to actually start broadening out what it means to be an effective coach. We need to change the reward structure. When people are only focused on one thing and that's what they get rewarded for, then you see the consequence of that. We need to start building capacity in organizations by funding roles which can facilitate change in organizations. And remember that the athletes themselves are the assets of the organization. So even if you only came at it from a bottom line perspective, it would be beneficial to the bottom line if you actually took care of this athlete. And remember that well-being is a performance enabler.
I love lots of those points. I want to dig slightly deeper into one of them, because the whole purpose of this podcast is bridging the gap between academia and professional practice. And I've got a real passion for translation of research into practice. And, you've said there, and I'm aware that unidimensional, this one-dimensional approach of things is not beneficial, potentially in the short term, but certainly in the long term, for performance and or well-being. So can you just dig into that a little bit and talk about some of those problems of one-dimensional and benefits of not being one-dimensional? Because I know it's growing in the understanding, but when you've got years and years and years, I'm talking, UK sports, where parents and many other people will be, you have to do this, it's now or never type attitude. I want to get the message across that that's not right. So no. How do we do that?
Well, again, I think it's education, and that takes time. But to be frank, I think generally speaking, sport has not always embraced learning, which is outside of the sport. And as a consequence, if it's not related to the sport discipline itself, it can be difficult to get engagement with people, and even more difficult to get people to engage in learning education. I'll just give you a really simple example, and I'll take Australia as the example. I know it's no different in the UK. Only 20% of people who start courses in sport finish them. And that's across a whole range of topics. So what does that tell you? Well, that probably tells you that either for time or money or for other reasons, and I think it's mainly for other reasons, that people aren't engaged in learning. And sport, professional sport and elite sport as an industry is really still in its infancy. And so because of that, and because of the transient nature of sport, because of the performance expectations, people move on very quickly. But because of that, people don't really embrace learning in the way they could. And the industry suffers because of it. And one area, I particularly passionate about, and the Wellbeing Science Institute is passionate about, is mental health. Now, mental health is a classic example where we've gone down the wrong path. We've gone down the stigma reduction, mental health awareness raising, and it's been a failed strategy. And where we should be focusing is on looking at the skills of flourishing, the affective skills, the psychological skills, the social skills, because we know those things are actually not only more likely to lead to positive mental health, but they're also buffering for the impacts and pressures of everyday life, which ultimately affect people's mental health. So the whole sporting industry has embraced this idea because we haven't been thinking, and all the resources, all the money and all the efforts have gone into something which there's already infrastructure in place. It might not be great infrastructure, but the real risk in mental health are people with moderate mental health, not the people who are actually languishing and actually experiencing poor mental health, because often they're on the way to getting treatment. So the vast majority of people have moderate mental health. Only about 20% of people are actually feeling good and functioning well. And so what about the mass in the middle? They're the ones at risk of languishing. And what are we doing for them? Absolutely nothing. And what's interesting to me is we don't actually measure the number of mentally healthy people. We don't measure that. Why don't we measure that? But we're quite happy to measure the number of people with mental ill health and then promote it as if it's, a good thing. So these are some contradictions, particularly in sport, that to me a part of the purpose of the Wellbeing Science Institute is to educate people, to skill them so that it can actually do these things and actually make a real difference to individuals, to athletes, coaches, officials, to organizations and their communities.
You've talked about measurement there, and it's a perfect transition into my next question, really, which was around how do you measure the short and long-term success of your program?
Yeah.
And I think we'll then move into a case study that I know we're going to talk about with the NRL.
Yeah, well, I think any good program, to me, measurement means accountability. In order to do this work, you've got to be willing to be accountable. So in well-being terms, I think you need to have very clear subjective well-being measures. You need to have very clear objective well-being measures, and you need to have very clear outcome measures. And you need to have all three. And if you don't have all three, you're not serious about actually your well-being program. So, with those three elements in place, you can track, subjective well-being, as we know, fluctuates. So you can track that over a period of time. But that's also going to be influenced, how I'm feeling on a given moment, how I'm performing, am I injured or not? Have I been selected? Is my contract coming up for renewal? All these other variables. But over time, we build a snapshot. So you've got to have means of measuring subjective well-being. Then you've got to have your objective measures, which relate to your program. Are people engaging with it? Are they getting benefits from it? Are the goals that people are setting individually, collectively, organizationally, are those goals being met? And then what outcomes? What outcomes for athletes? What outcomes for the organization? What outcomes for the community? Because I also don't think you can do well-being effectively unless it works from the inside out. And it's got to be working on the outside as well for your community, for your fans and those kind of things. And again, there's a massive, just like with women's sport, with well-being, there's a massive commercial opportunity for working with your sponsors, working with your community groups, working with governments to fund this whole strategic approach to well-being. But again, it's early days, so many people haven't seen that opportunity yet, but I suspect it's coming pretty soon.
Yeah, like you said, the three organisations that have, out of the hundreds that could, should, and hopefully will start to move forward in this space. I've spoken a little bit there about that the long-term measure, and I know that you've been working with the NRL in Australia for quite some time now. So can you just talk us through what you've done with the NRL and how you have evidenced the success of your program?
Well, I should preface my comments by saying I have been working with the NRL. They've done the heavy lifting. They've done the hard yards. And I've been more a bit player in providing a strategic direction, some clarity around what systemic organizational well-being looks like from the players and coaches and officials' point of view, and then help them develop a strategy for the organization, which is now in its seventh year, and trained every well-being manager in the organization so they're qualified, so there's minimum standards. And there's no other sport in the world, by the way, that has minimum standards for people who work in well-being, and those minimum standards are well-being qualifications. So that alone talks to their investment. And then there's a process where well-being managers who are qualified actually, you know, sit down with players and get to know them as a person, really get to know them, spend time, you know, hearing their life story, asking them what areas of well-being that they may be interested in focusing on. Then they, you know, after they come to some sort of agreement on the focus areas, setting some well-being goals with them, and then having a customized well-being plan developed for them. And the whole program is opt-in, it's not compulsory. And currently the rates of uptake are around 85%. Now, I'm not saying, and the NRL would agree with me, it's not perfect yet, but I tell you what, they're a long way out in front when it comes to having systemic organizational well-being, which is focused on their elite athletes, that's well-resourced, well-funded, and where there's been a significant improvement in not only player well-being, but also there's a significant demonstration that if you invest in well-being in the right way, you get performance benefits. So 7 of the top clubs in the well-being ratings are actually 7 of the 8 clubs on the premiership table. And that's been the case for a number of years. So I think, you know, again, well-being as a performance enabler.
I think, as well, just for context, because look, as I've mentioned to you already, I lived in Australia. I loved the NRL. I've been to a State of Origin game. Phenomenal. So mine was back in the days of Jared Hayne and Billy Slater and Jonathan Thurston, some top players that I got to watch. But I'm not sure if the UK would quite understand the context of the cultural change that may have been required in the NRL and yep. off-field issues that they may have had. So can you just put a bit of context on any off-field issues that they may have had and where they're at now?
Yeah, look, I think NRL would be one of the first to recognise that it's a very working-class sport. I'm from a working-class background myself, so I grew up knowing the NRL, played football as well, but NRL had some significant off-field challenges, and part of the rationale for investing in well-being was because, one, the athletes were full-time professionals who had, you know, reasonable amounts of money, disposable income that perhaps they hadn't had exposure to before, and there was a culture where things were not going well off the field. There'd been several suicides from mental health issues. And so the NRL really wanted to do something of significance. So they initially funded a well-being manager in each club. And at the time when they initially funded that, you know, people said, well, what are they going to do? Well, initially, it was actually called a welfare function. And part of my role was to start to say, well, the name is important, just like the definition is important. So it went from welfare and education to being well-being in education, which was a much more proactive, holistic and developmental focus. So rather than reacting to problems, it was about, okay, how do we get ahead of them? And so that's been, you know, some of those off-field issues around excessive drinking cultures, poor behavior toward the community, of problems with women. Those were some of the key catalysts, and of course mental health and suicide was some of the key drivers of why they wanted to make the investment. And I should also say that, you know, the Rugby League Players Association has been highly influential in advocating change. So, you know, the NRL and the Rugby League Players Association both have had, I think, outstanding leadership. They don't always see it eye to eye, but they've certainly had outstanding leadership in the way in which they're on the same page when it comes to player well-being.
I really like to have that case study, because it shows we've gone through how your approach to well-being, how you've got kind of your models in place and your systems in place, and how that can manifest itself in ideally cultural change throughout a whole organisation through working with and influencing, you know, the NRL and others. So it's really nice to see. And it brings me round to working with Loughborough. So, you know, I know now you're working with Loughborough, than you have done for the last few years. How did that come about? And what are you doing with us at Loughborough?
Well, I was actually in Brisbane, running a program in Brisbane, and I got a message from Simon Womberill from Performance Lifestyle Team. And he said, look, I've just seen your course and I'd be interested in having a chat with you about it. So we got on the phone and had a conversation, and and pretty quickly it was clear that Simon and myself saw eye to eye on holistic athlete development and well-being. And Simon asked if I would have any interest in coming to Loughborough and running the course. So I came across in 2019. We sat down, initially talked about how it might work in reality. We ran the first program, and in the first program we had a real diversity of people on the program. We had people from football, from West Ham, if I remember correctly, from people from the LMA on the course, people from rugby league, people from Loughborough, people from para sports. It was a real mixture of people. And after the success of that first program, we talked about what else could we do. And so part of that what else could we do was to start thinking about how we could build other connections, not just around the course, but also in terms of wellbeing research, in wellbeing events, and of course in a genuine partnership in potentially consulting.
Brilliant. And what do you feel has been the impact so far of working with Loughborough?
Well, you know, obviously Loughborough has a reputation in sport around the world for, you know, helping provide an environment where athletes can flourish. I think what we're bringing to Loughborough, the Wellbeing Science Institute is bringing to Loughborough, is helping them create this footprint in world-class wellbeing. And I think that will be seen both in the impact, and I know I've talked to Simon about this, some of the changes they've already made in their performance lifestyle team as a result of doing the course. I think that's really healthy. I think other universities are now coming. In our most recent course, we had some other universities coming and doing the course because they want to work with their performance lifestyle teams as well, supporting student athletes. I think we're starting to build a real footprint in football. So we've had people from Manchester City, Liverpool, Arsenal, West Ham, Aston Villa. So we've had some great, you know, football organizations, lots of people from other professional sports outside the Olympic area. So that's been really great to see Loughborough starting to expand into those areas that perhaps previously they weren't. But I think it is a genuine collaboration. I think it's a partnership. And, you know, we're hopeful that it continues to grow. I think the evidence is that the reputation of the course is growing. I think there's a definite need, but I think at the end of the day, it's about people. And I think, you know, we're helping sporting organizations take care, better care of their people, not by doing things for them, not by doing things to them, but by actually creating this space where, you know, wellbeing can be co-created. But it takes everybody in the organization to understand its value.
And if there's people listening now who want to be part of that course, is there a way that they can find more information about it to get on it?
Yeah, they can go to our website, which is wellbeingscienceinstitute.com, or they can go to the Loughborough website. We'll have information about our next course, which is coming up in September.
Perfect. Well, Steve, it's been great talking to you. You've given us so much good insight into wellbeing, how you've kind of, your career, which was fascinating at the start, how you've developed the Wellbeing Science Institute, and how you're delivering on where your passion is. And it's great to hear, and it's awesome to see, hopefully, long-term cultural change in the NRL and starting to have some impact upon UK sport through the relationship with Loughborough. So I want to thank you for your time. Hopefully, we get to meet again, and hopefully we get to meet in person. I mean, it could be in Loughborough, but ideally in Sydney, potentially. I know a really good coffee place on Frenchman's Road, which was my favourite. So if I'm in Sydney again and you're around, we can definitely go for a nice coffee in Sydney.
I very much look forward to that. I've brought my coffee with me, so that tells you where I'm at, man. Thanks for
yes.
having me. Great chatting with you.
Really no, amazing. It. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Experts in Sport. If you'd like to get in touch to discuss any topics that you'd like to hear about, then contact me, Martin Foster, via my email, m.foster@alborough.ac.uk. Bye for now. See you next time.